Valley is the story of my teeth, mm-hmm. which also references a lot of Petrarch and other kinds of books. And Petrarch himself is another good example of someone who's engaged with these other texts. And then there's a tradition of doing that in Japanese literature with Basho. And it's his book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which includes these walking pilgrimages to sites that other poets had traveled to, and he records their poems and meditates on them, and then composes his own poems in response. So there's a lot of...
So Zebra would have liked that book.
Yeah. I've read that book quite a number of times, and I just... It's very slow and meditative, but I absolutely love it, yeah.
So if we were to move on to Don Quixote in mm-hmm. relationship to this book, the place where I feel like there's the deepest resonance is in the way you portray the romantic relationship between Zebra and the philologist, the Italian philologist, Ludo Bembo, her on-again, off-again love affair with him. So that's sort of the source of both the book's tension mm-hmm. and also a lot of its humor.
Yeah.
And it's also the place where we most experience the limitations of Zebra's own self-narrative. It's the place where we can see around the way she presents the world to us. So mm-hmm. we start to see like, oh, this world seems like it's hermetic and perfected, and yet there's some, it's also producing some difficulties for her, particularly in the romantic world. But it made me think of the similar relationship between Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. Yeah. With Quixote, he has the fever, sort of the feverish imaginative life. He's even tall and skinny and not really, he's more otherworldly in a mm-hmm. bodily sense, and Panza is motivated by the appetites of the world. And here we have Zebra as almost a disembodied character. She hardly eats. She's ruminating all the time. She's tormented by her exile, her absence of home, and like her ancestors, finds her home in the world of words. But in an ironic way, even though she finds a home in the world of words, she's exiled from her body.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, she's kind of living off of the words mm-hmm. as her food. I was ready to devour the next sentence, to eat Benjamin quoting Hegel, to consume an infinitely receding sequence of quotes, which mm-hmm. again gives us that layering that you wouldn't see in Los Angeles, but you'd see in Italy. But Ludo's the polar opposite, exasperatingly so, to Zebra. He's practical. He's equally interested in language, but it's a more practical sort of engagement with the text. and I think in the Los Angeles Review of Books, it's described as performing autopsies on textual cadavers while Zebra is the mad writer who Frankensteins them into a living monster. That's pretty awesome. And he's really into food and sex, the pleasures of life. He's an embodied character. You've created this inextricable pair, like mm-hmm. in Don Quixote. So I was just hoping you'd talk more about Ludo and the role, which feels like a vital role. I can't imagine the book without him.
Yeah, neither can I. Actually, I started working on this book in 2010, and I was doing the background research and just kind of reading all these writers of exile. But when I started writing, 2 or 3 years after that, the first thing that appeared on the page was Ludo Bembo. Mm. And it was the breakup scene that we get towards the end of the book, that first kind of rupture in the relationship where he's just had enough of her, and he's trying to reflect sort of the ways in which she's perpetuating exile or rejection or alienation, right? Without intending to, of course, but he reflects this back to her. And there... It's also where all the humor, like you said, in the book comes from. I mean, I think this book is deeply tragic, but it's also very comical. And that's due to the fact that the two of them are kind of pushing and pulling each other across the Mediterranean. And they're both very intelligent people. But of course, like you said, he's so much more pragmatic. He's really interested in the history of the definition of words and in dictionaries. And he has this great sort of recitation of all the different definitions of exile that he kind of lashes at her, against her with, while she's listening to all the other pilgrims of exile or the void come up with what exile feels like for them, like what are their personal definitions of exile. Mm. And he's really interested in like the sort of the book, right? What does the dictionary say exile means? And he's very concrete and frustrating in that way to her. And mm-hmm. she's, of course, maddening to him.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I love it. I'm glad I'm not in it, but I love to read
nice
about
to
it.
Nice to witness.
Yeah. So there are a lot of ironies. There's a lot of absurdist humor, but there's also a lot of ironies. For instance, as the last of an ancestral lineage, Zebra reminds the reader that she carries this great weight of responsibility. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't just manifest as the need to preserve the wisdom of her family of autodidacts and atheists and anarchists, but from the humor perspective, she's also literally carrying things around, objects she's inherited, stained rugs, a rolled up portrait of a duck, a samovar, even her dead father in a suitcase at one point. And one tragic irony of this is that this is all in response to being exiled and feeling othered no matter where she goes. So it's this act of sort of desperate preservation. But even though it's an act of love toward her parents, it sort of becomes a fortress. Mm-hmm. She's not capable of engaging with the other, of creating space in her heart for the real embodied otherness of this man in her life, for loving a living person, even though she's defining herself through otherness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's sort of the danger of all of her thinking, of our sort of hyper intellectualism and this cerebral way in which she goes through the world. And I think that it's the relationship with Ludo that eventually allows us as readers to see that the boundary between the victim and the victimizer is blurry, and that violence, when this kind of deep historical violence, has so many subconscious ways of reproducing itself, and that in fact the more she holds on to her grief, the more she's perpetuating this form of psychological or emotional exile, including toward herself, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't live from the heart in any way, and a lot of what her journey is about is actually to question whether or not she's ever been loved, if she knows what that is, and to think, you know, what is love and how do we love ourselves? How do we nurture each other? And she eventually does realize that her biggest revenge as an exiled body is in fact to lay claim to love, right? Mm-hmm. And to make space for that. And I think that's where sort of we part with her, right? Is because there are no easy resolutions in a situation like this. And I definitely didn't want this, you know, big redemptive arc, because I don't think that's the way we resolve our trauma, right? It's not in one instance, or it's not in one epiphany. It's a constant returning to and trying to sort of crack away at the bricks in those walls little by little over a lifetime in order to sort of get on the other side. Yeah.
One of the things she feels with regards to Ludo is a difference in the way they are oriented towards exile.
Yeah.
So there's various terms that are in her worldview that she's inherited, and one of them is the pyramid of exile. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about the pyramid of exile in relationship to the way she looks at her potential romantic partner, mm-hmm. and maybe ways in which she doesn't feel like she can cross over and feel seen by him because of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the pyramid of exile is one of those theories she constructs as she's leaving the new world, and it's deeply serious but also very funny in the way that she's sort of goes on this long monologue about the pyramid of exile and who's on the bottom of the pyramid, who's in the middle, who's on top. And she sort of starts to think about there are lots of people who are below her, who are suffering even more, and who are refugees without documentation, who you know, die in the process of getting across the Mediterranean. And she refers to the Mediterranean as the Sea of Sunken Hopes. And then there are people like herself who are sort of in the middle of the pyramid, and who are displaced or in exile, but you know, chose to flee, were able to eventually, whether, you know, by hook or by crook, somehow acquire documentation and therefore can come and go. And then she thinks about people like Ludo Bembo, who are at the top and they get the most amount of oxygen because they're standing on everyone else's shoulders, who are expats, right? So Ludo is an Italian philologist who's displaced in Spain as a result of sort of like the environment Berlusconi has created in Italy. And she believes that they're the most well-off, right, within this pyramid. And she doesn't think that he can ever really understand, mm-hmm. just like she can never fully understand the pain of the people who she feels she's standing on their shoulders, right? And I think it, for me, and I think eventually for Zebra, this is another way in which we're all interconnected, right? Herself, the definitions of who she is, are not separate from her awareness of this kind of huge machinery of power, right, that we're all implicated in. And so through that, we're deeply connected, whether it's through the ways in which we acquire wealth or freedom or oxygen or diminish someone else's, that, you know, again, that's the fabric, right, that we're living in.
Yeah. Well, even though this book feels clearly like a fiction, there are ways it also sort of feels like an imaginative rereading of your own family story of exile, or like that this is a fictional palimpsest atop an autobiographical inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
Like Zebra, your family left Iran as exiles. You lived in innumerable places while growing up. Spain was a particularly notable place of transition for you. And is also the main locale of the novel. And the main love interest in the book is with an Italian. Your husband is Italian. And I'm by no means suggesting that I think Zebra is you. But I'd love to mine the gap a little between the fiction you've created and, mm-hmm. and your own life. Particularly the literary pilgrimages that Zebra does when she's in Spain. Pilgrimages centered around writers who have experienced some form of exile themselves, and your own literary pilgrimages that you did while living in Spain, and that involved you using books instead of maps or books as maps to find out where to go. So can you speak about the pilgrimages on their own, but also maybe how they're informing the ones in the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you're right to say that this is a kind of fictional autobiography, or it's playing with that genre. I was consciously toying with the idea of dramatizing aspects of my own life and seeing how, in the Borgesian sense, that would shift my relationship to myself as a writer and also complicate it in a way, and how these inventions of these selves through Zebra would then mirror something back to me that I couldn't know unless I had written this book. And it's also certainly an intellectual autobiography for me. My family, they actually weren't big readers, so that's completely fictional. They're definitely not anarchists, atheists, or autodidacts, although my father is somewhat of an autodidact and a very kind of, I would say, reclusive character. And he's Dutch and a sea captain and spent a lot of his time at sea. And I grew up mainly with my mother and that side of the family. So in some senses, all of the deep grief and the emotions that Zebra explores in the novel are also feelings that I've had to navigate, of displacement, of figuring out how to kind of deal with that line of being the outsider and resisting maybe or complicating for people the stories that they invent for you, right? When they don't know what box to fit you in. So there's that. And I do feel strongly about acknowledging that, right? And at the same time, this book sort of is so strange. And it, the only way that it could be honest is if it became radically strange and other to me. And so when I read it, my experience is quite uncanny. I don't recognize myself in it. But I do remember, of course, the writing process being very difficult. I laughed a lot, but I also, you know, wept a lot writing it. So I think I'm forgetting the second part of your question.
The second part's about the walking.
Oh, right.
So
right.
The walking you did in Catalonia without maps.
Yeah.
And what was impelling that yeah. journey and how that intersects with the pilgrimages in the book.
Yeah. So I got the Fulbright to go and do background research for this novel. And as it turns out, I wasn't actually emotionally mature enough to know what I was doing, right? Mm. I mean, I had to kind of, our writing self, I truly believe, is ahead of our world self. And there was a lot of catching up I had to do. So I had this kind of project in mind that I was going to go and research Josep Pla's work and his relationship to the Catalan landscape, and then read other writers of exile and think about the ways in which history or trauma are embedded in the landscape. But for so long, I didn't understand why I needed to do this. And once I was there, the only thing I could do in order to kind of break into that or gain understanding was to start going on these walks, these pilgrimages with his books, and then with Rodoreda's books. And then I went to Port Bow, where Walter Benjamin committed suicide on the border with France. And I didn't have maps. We didn't use technology. And he was my future husband at that point. Leonardo did these walks with me. And we were also kind of thinking about what do journeys mean, and how can we sort of travel locally with the same electric energy you would set off on a long kind of journey to a faraway place with. And part of accomplishing that was actually making the space unfamiliar to ourselves and reading the books and trying to trace, look at spaces that were described in the books, and then go to those locations and see if those spaces still look the same or still existed. And in a lot of cases, they didn't. Or in a lot of cases, we would have to kind of walk across the old railroad tracks to the old road that they would travel on with donkeys. And we got lost a lot. And we also had so much fun. And we wrote for Words Without Borders. So a lot of those early pilgrimages that then, when I finally had the maturity to write the book, got recast in a much more fictionalized, dramatic way in the book we wrote early on. Yeah.
Can you talk about your attraction to Catalonian literature or Catalan writers? Why is Josep Pla play such a significant role in the book and in these pilgrimages, for instance?
Yeah, when we lived in Spain, we were in Valencia, and they speak Valencia, which is very, you know, it's Catalan. It just has a slightly different inflection to it. And so I grew up with Catalan in my ear. And it's just, I don't know what it is about it, but it just kind of, the frequency of the language, the tone, especially the way that the vowels are pronounced, just kind of grabs my heart. And of course, it's one of those things you just don't know why that is, right? Like sometimes you listen to a piece of music and everything in you changes for just that one moment. So for me, reading Catalan literature has that.
So is it?
Yeah.
Do these writers are they engaged with the theme of exile, or is it more the sound of the language almost being the attraction of a home?
Well, it depends on the writer. So Mercé Rodoreda, the book of hers that I absolutely love, was written in exile about the Spanish Civil War and the time of the doves. And she wrote that when she was in France. And it's It's an absolutely stunning work. Very simple, deceptively simple sentences that kind of accumulate into this emotional complex space, or you know, it's narrative through accumulation. And Josep Pla has that same kind of very direct, almost sort of severe delivery of sentences, and it's in the way that they accumulate paragraph after paragraph that you really start to get a feeling for how passionate he was as a writer. Because if you just read a few pages, it's hard to really capture that. But he spent his whole life having to deal with these very deeply conflicting sides of his personality. He was deeply Catholic. He was also a fervent Catalanist. And of course, during the Civil War, those two identities couldn't coexist, right? Because you had the Franco, who was kind of conservative and Catholic, and the oppression of the Catalans that happened during Franco and his long dictatorship. And so, you know, Pla was kind of left neither here nor there. So I think I'm more interested in his identity and in the way that somehow through the course of history, his identity always trapped him and cornered him. No matter what was going on, he always seemed to land on the wrong side of the line. Mm. And he just wrote, I think, maniacally as a coping mechanism, but also to leave a record of the territory, the food,
and what book should we start with?
Well, he's only begun to get translated into English recently. So the book of his that I absolutely love, The Grey Notebook, is actually published by the New York Review of Books. And it's phenomenal. The translation is great. Archipelago also has published, I think it's Life in Bitters. And I'm hoping more of his work will be translated into English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the conspicuous absences in the grand tour of exile for Zebra is she doesn't go to Iran.
Yeah.
And you haven't been back since you were young either, I don't believe.
I haven't.
But were you ever tempted to imagine yourself there in the narrative, or imagine Zebra there in the return?
Yeah, I mean, that was the goal, right? She wants to reverse and retrace the path all the way, and I don't want to give too much away, but I think she of course, you know, realizes the impossibility of that and the fact that it's basically a suicidal project. And thankfully, it's the digression with Ludo that allows her to come to terms with that, and realizing that it's her desire to go back has so much more to do with not knowing how to grieve the loss of her mother, right? And once she figures out how to grieve that, the absence of Iran is extraordinarily painful, but she's able to hold it. And yeah, I wish I could go back every day, you know, of course.
Well, in your Twitter profile, you describe yourself as a transnational body. And recently I've been preparing for an interview with Molly Crabapple about her upcoming memoir about the Syrian war.
Mm-hmm.
And she tweeted the phrase "borders kill" recently. And when I was thinking about the transnational body and both the arbitrariness and lethality of borders, it made me think of a past interview I had with Yanara Friedland. I don't know if you read her book, The Uncountry.
No, I haven't.
Her book, Uncountry, it feels like a kindred spirit to Call Me Zebra. It doesn't read anything like it tonally, syntactically. It's a very different reading experience, but it raises questions of identity and lineage in relationship
from
to
Boo,
exile. From
the
place.
Weekly segment from
and,
people
and she
inside
took the title
of
her book from a quote
Kebu
by Alain
with news
Sitsu,
from your community goes, radio station.
I want the word uncountry. I am sorry we don't have it, since uncountry is not supposed to exist. I like beings who belong to removal inhabitants of the uncountry, of the in-country, of the country hidden in the country or lost in the country, of the other country, the country below, the country underneath. And then Friedland herself says, in essence, the task the book proposes is to string and build connection to that and those beyond our immediate association of nation and citizenship, the identity markers we are born into, and to imagine lineages that live within us, contradicting inherited narratives. I do think, however, that this must always happen after a confrontation and untangling of our more immediate bonds, or in other words, the reaching beyond ourselves begins at the center, slowly rippling out. Mm-hmm. I want to emphasize that this is not a territorial act, claiming all kinds of subjectivities as our own, but rather an encounter at the boundary of I and thou, in Buber's words. And this feels very akin to Zebra's attempt, mm-hmm. somehow to me, of finding home in a spatialized imagination in an uncountry whose inhabitants are also her ancestors and also the stories of people, the stories that her ancestors loved and the stories that she loves, all sort of in this almost mythological space. I just wanted to hear your response to some of that.
That's such a beautiful quote. I'd love to read that book. I think it's actually articulated so concisely something that's so difficult to get at, which is, precisely this idea that it's in the encounter with the person next to you, in a deep sort of examination of the historical knots that have informed every aspect of your relating to one another, that you're then able to transcend, I think is a slightly problematic word, but to transcend the notion of national boundaries, right? That you can't skip over the interrogation of the sets of relationships that surround you in the countries that we've landed in, right? That there is no way for Zebra to understand what happened to her family or even between her and her father without fully deeply immersing herself in the relationship with Ludo and looking at the ways in which her trauma and her expectations get replayed in that relationship and therefore distort it, right? Mm-hmm. And distort him and the ways in which the things that have informed his life in turn further distort hers, right? That there is a kind of deep acknowledging that needs to occur of even the stuff that we think we're not responsible for, that our ancestors did or thought of or taught us, right? We are responsible for those things, right? I think, you know, if we're talking about them, something like epigenetics, right, the way that trauma gets inherited or passed on across generations, then it's in our bodies, right? We're interacting with one another with all of that. And the more we can be aware of it, I think the more we can be in an uncountry, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to return to you and the high bar you set about wanting to change when you do a book, when you mm-hmm. write a book, I know you have a couple manuscripts in progress, and I'm curious what this meditation on exile and place, on love and otherness, an experience that led you to say, maybe not all of our emotions belong to us and not all of our thoughts are our own. We've inherited these things we perform again and again, and landscape really shows that to us. I got to sit with that idea for a prolonged period with this book. So I'm curious what this prolonged period has prompted you to explore next.
Yeah, it's freed me, I think, to write essays, which I wasn't able to do before. It has made the experience, my experience of exile, more accessible to me and more immediate, because I had to dig around for language that I didn't have before. And once I created the language for talking about the deep loneliness, the strangeness, the sense of futility, right? And at times even a kind of a lack of conviction of, you know, a sense of purpose or sort of what is it that we are living against and living through. I think that having written this book, I'm now able to write about those things unapologetically, I suppose, mm-hmm. because there's a way in which when you don't have language for these things, it creates so much shame and so much internal sort of atmospheric oppression that it's disorienting within itself. So it's almost as if there's this deep turbulence within you all of the time. And I was able to go into the turbulence. I mean, it took 7 years, and it maybe that's not that long after all, but it feels long to me since I've only been around for 34. So it's sort of, yeah, I'm not afraid of it anymore now.
Well, thanks for being on the show today, Azarine.
Thank you so much for your very thoughtful questions and the conversation. I appreciate it.
We're talking today to Azarine Vandervliet Alumi about her latest book, Call Me Zebra. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 20 de mayo del 2021. Con las variantes brasileña y británica circulando ampliamente en Argentina, los pacientes que están viendo ahora en el Hospital Público Fernández en Buenos Aires están muriendo más rápido y son más jóvenes. Una víctima reciente solo tenía 42 años. Una segunda ola devastadora de casos de COVID tomó a Argentina con la guardia baja, con restricciones relajadas y una baja tasa de vacunación. Los casos han aumentado de un total diario de alrededor de 5.000 a principios de marzo a un récord de